Hi, this is Chris Kepler with Does This Happen to You? The podcast where we explore the more bizarre ways of getting through your day. This week, we have two stories, and we're going to start out with Things I Do That Drive My Husband Nuts by Emily Friedel. I say husband, but I'm not entirely sure we're married. We were wed in the back of a limo in Vegas to the tune of I Want to Be Sedated. The wedding was too cheap for us to have chosen a song, but it was a pleasant surprise. My husband is a big Ramones fan. I wore an $8 op shop denim dress. Rohan wore his best flanny, and the ceremony performed by a woman named Jamie, who was almost certainly an ex-porn star. Classy. The entire process took approximately 12 minutes, photos and all. We never received any paperwork and never bothered to follow it up, so it's quite possible our marriage isn't legally recognized in Australia. The worst part is I'm never sure what I should write when asked for my marital status on forms. Anyway, 5 years later and we're still together. We've been through some tough times and had plenty of adventures together and, of course, we get on each other's nerves at times. Here are a few things I do that drive my husband nuts. 1. I get dazed in supermarkets. I can't help it. All the bright colors and the crappy pop music and the dodging of specials chasing old ladies. It's sensory overload, and I end up standing in front of the particularly colorful displays, lollies, jaws agape, drooling slightly, and semi-catatonic. Rohan usually has to walk back for the next aisle, grab me by the arm, and drag me around for the rest of the grocery shopping. He doesn't let me come to the supermarket very often, and I can't be trusted on my own. 2. I don't put the new toilet roll on the toilet roll holder properly. Instead, I sit the toilet roll on the cistern, or on the floor, or upright on the toilet roll holder because I like to hold the toilet roll. It makes it easier to dispense just the right amount of squares. Rohan finds this infuriating and can't understand why I won't just slide the roll onto the holder. I've tried, I really have, going a whole week or more where I've managed to pull the roll on the holder. Invariably, though, I fall back into my old habits. At least when I do put the roll on, I put it on the right way. Rohan puts it on underhand, which is a much greater sin than not putting it on at all, in my opinion. 3. I am a dunahog and very bad at sleeping. I have never been a good sleeper. I toss and turn a lot during the night. I have a unique method for turning over under the duna. I hold the duna up and keep holding it up with arms and legs while quickly rolling underneath, so the duna stays in place when I turn over instead of being pulled to the side. Apparently, this results in the duna being lifted off Rohan and settling off him once the turning frenzy is done, which he finds objectionable. This problem has largely been resolved by using separate dunas, but I do still receive the odd look of disapproval after a particularly restless night. 4. Sometimes I eat more than my fair share of the ice cream. When we first met, we did a lot of training together. That's not a euphemism. Saturdays we'd have an especially intense session, which led to a tradition of Indian takeaway and ice cream and beer on Saturday nights. We started out romantically with 2 spoons and 1 carton of Maggie Beer's Burnt Fig, honeycomb and caramel ice cream. It didn't last long. I was accused of mining for caramel pockets and consuming more than my half of the ice cream to reach said caramel pockets. Much like the dunas, this was resolved by getting separate buckets of ice cream. However, there was an incident with some mince pie ice cream almost 2 years ago that I haven't heard the end of. He left me alone with the ice cream. He knows I have no self-control, so I maintain it's his fault. 5. I take a long time to take a photo. I love photography, but I'm not good at it, so my approach is to take a million photos and hope one works out. without fail if my husband is around. He'll roll his eyes and say, "Hurry up, Annie Leibovitz." You should see the tortured look that engulfs his face if I ask him to be in the photo. These are the things I do that drive my husband nuts that I'm aware of. I'm sure there are dozens more. I can be pretty annoying. But you need to have some mystery in a relationship, so I'm not going to ask. Be sure to follow Emily on Medium.com. And now we have episode 2 of A Love Story of Sorts.
Jennifer, what the hell are you doing?
John said, hovering above me with a look of disbelief on his face. I struggled to focus my eyes and my mind, but they were blurred by the thumping pulse of my heart. I'm pregnant, and I think I'm having a miscarriage.
You're what? Does Robbie know?
Yes.
Where the hell is he?
I don't know. I think we broke up yesterday.
Jesus Christ, Jennifer!
I know. Just call an ambulance. The ambulance ride is stored in a fuzzy part of my memory. The only thing I really remember was getting my blood pressure taken. That and both paramedics were undeniably good-looking. 58/48, he said with surprise in his voice as he glanced at his partner with raised eyebrows. Worried, I ask, "Isn't that kind of low?"
"Oh, hey," he said in a lower, genteel voice. He brushed some errant strands of copper hair away from my eyes like a mother with her sick child.
"Yeah, it's pretty low."
"Why do you think it's so low?" I ask.
"I'm not sure. It's probably because of the amount of pain you're in. Try to relax. We'll have you at the hospital in no time."
"GSW to the chest coming through. Make a lane!" someone shouted from behind us.
The cute EMT pulled over to the wall like you might if an ambulance was coming up behind you while driving. Thanks to many years of watching ER long past its prime, I knew that a GSW was a gunshot wound. I opened my eyes just in time to see a guy who was handcuffed to a gurney writhe in pain, his free hand clutching the bloody hole in his chest. He's worse off than I am. I shouldn't be feeling so sorry for myself. It's odd, though. They feel it necessary to handcuff him to the gurney. This isn't the movies where a gunshot wound is a pesky little bee sting. Could he really just pop up and run away without being caught? My thoughts on the GSW were interrupted when the cute EMT handed me over to a nurse. Before he left, he squeezed my hand and said, "Don't worry, you're in good hands." Sad to see him go, I watched him weave in and out of the busy emergency room traffic until he disappeared from sight. Now I was in a small room. The obligatory blood pressure sleeve slipped onto my arm as the nurse went through the same battery of questions I'd already cycled through with the paramedics. "I understand you're pregnant," she said, glancing at my chart, expressionless. It was almost like I was interrupting something that was much more important.
"Yes," I said.
"Do you know how far along?"
I think I'm about 8 weeks."
"Well, I'm going to order an ultrasound to make sure the baby is okay. Just hold tight. Someone will be with you in a moment." She turned and disappeared into the white light of the hallway.
God, it's awful to think, but I almost wish there was a complication. My problem would be solved without me having to actually make a decision. Am I going to burn in hell for thinking that?
"Hi there, Miss Hess."
"Yeah," I replied. I strained to turn toward the door to see who was talking. It was a young guy, who I'd assume was a male nurse. I know it's cliche and immature, but the thought of a male nurse made me giggle.
"Hi, I'm Dr. Smith, and I'm here to do an ultrasound. We want to make sure your baby is okay," he said, as he brushed aside the hospital gown, exposing my stomach. I felt exposed, uncomfortable, embarrassed. Why? He had no idea what my story was. For all he knew, I was happily married and planned to have this baby all along. For all he knew, I did cartwheels when that EPT turned positive. Why do I even care what he thinks about me?
"This is going to be a little cold," he warned, and squirted the ultrasound goo on my exposed belly.
"You're a doctor? You look kind of young to be a doctor," I said.
"I'm an intern, ma'am. Rest assured you're in good hands," he replied with a forced smile, as if it wasn't the first time someone had noticed his youth. He was just the kind of guy John would want me to be with. Even though most people would consider him attractive, the thought of me being with him, or someone like him, disgusted me. I imagined his soft, uncalloused hands gliding along my body with the cold precision of a doctor. Gross. He moved the wand around on my belly for a few minutes. I lay there, motionless. I bit my lip and clenched my fists at times to hold back the urge to cry out in pain.
"Ah, good. There it is," he said with relief, pointing to a fuzzy blob on the screen.
"What?" I asked, curious.
"The embryo. It's implanted in your uterus. You see that little smudge right there?" he replied, still pointing at the screen. "We were initially concerned that you could be having an ectopic pregnancy."
Bummer. Now what do I do?
"Oh, what's that?" I strained to speak.
"An ectopic pregnancy occurs when the fertilized egg implants in your fallopian tube. If gone undetected, the tube can rupture and the pregnancy is lost. Since you presented with excessive pain, we thought it was a possibility."
"Oh, so if it isn't an egg, whatever you just called it, why does it feel like there's an elephant sitting on my chest?"
"We aren't 100% sure just yet. It could just be regular pain associated with the pregnancy. We're going to observe you for a while longer. Sit tight, and I'll be back in a few minutes."
"Regular pregnancy pain? Are you fucking kidding me? If this was normal pregnancy pain, there is no way this species ever would have propagated."
He looked at me, puzzled. I wasn't sure if it was a surprise that I just dropped an F-bomb, or a look of disbelief that I could possibly be in that much pain. Probably both. About an hour passed, and I was still waiting for either my brother or Robbie to appear. Finally, they showed up together at around 8 p.m.
"Look what the cat threw up," said John, pointing back towards a guilty-looking Robbie.
Robbie rushed into the room and stooped down beside me.
"So, what's going on?" Robbie asked.
His concern seemed genuine.
"I feel like I'm dying," I responded.
"No, seriously, what's happening?" I turned away from him so I didn't have to look at him and said, "Rob, if there was ever a time to believe what I'm saying and not question me now would be the time. I feel like I'm dying and they don't know what the fuck is wrong with me."
Okay, I'm sorry," he said. He reached for my hand, but I pulled it away before he could hold it.
"They thought I could have this one thing where the egg is fertilized in the fallopian tube, but a doctor took an ultrasound and showed me that the embryo is in the uterus."
"So that's good, right?" Robbie asked.
"I guess a person who actually wanted to have a baby would think it's good, but you know."
"Jennifer, if you don't mind, stop talking all about that baby stuff. You know I have a vaginal phobia," John chimed in.
"John, honey, if you don't mind, I'm in a lot of fucking pain right now, and I am not in the mood for your bullshit. So I love you, and I mean it, but shut the fuck up, please," I said, eking out a fake smile.
"Okay, your highness, jeez, I was just trying to lighten the mood a little."
I noticed Robbie was no longer in the room.
"Where did he go?" I asked.
"Oh, he's running around being all macho, telling everybody his dad is an attorney, and if he doesn't get some answers, there's going to be hell to pay," John replied.
"Interesting. Suddenly he cares?"
"Jennifer, could you just this once not be a bitch and let him take care of you?" After a long pause, I sighed and said, "I suppose." "Now," John added, "I'm going to go try and get hold of Mom."
"What? Seriously, is that really necessary?"
"Jennifer, you're in the hospital. She's your mother. Yes, I'm calling her, and yes, I'm telling her you're pregnant."
"Okay, that's fine, but don't tell her that Robbie and I broke up. I don't need that drama."
Fine, he replied, and he left the room in search of a phone. I wasn't alone with my thoughts long enough to actually think anything before Robbie reappeared.
Oh, my God, honey, you're so pale, he said.
He leaned down and kissed my forehead. Heeding my brother's advice, I resisted the urge to pull away.
Are you feeling any better?
No, I think I'm worse. I'm very weak and very tired, and the pain, it isn't getting any better.
I don't understand what is happening to me. Did you find anything out?
By this time, it was about 10 p.m.
Not really. They've paged the on-call ultrasound technician. They want to do an internal ultrasound to see if they missed something earlier. I guess there isn't anyone here who's qualified to perform one.
Good, I heard John say. He was standing in the doorway. I'm going to get out of here.
Robbie, you need to call me ASAP when they figure out what the hell is wrong.
Toodles! Oh, by the way, Mom is taking the first flight out of Philly in the morning. Bye! John blew me a kiss, and before I could complain about my mother's pending arrival, he'd already disappeared.
Fuck! Why did he have to do that? It just makes it more dramatic than it needs to be.
We don't even know what's wrong with me at this point, I said.
Robbie squeezed my hand. Don't worry about that now. Just try to relax.
At about 12:30 a.m., a lone ultrasound technician entered my room. His sandy blonde hair was tousled like he'd just rolled out of bed. His unshaven beard with patches of gray and the annoyed look on his face made him look older than he probably was. A tie-dyed shirt peeked out from the V-neck of his scrubs. It was purple and turquoise.
I'm going to need your help getting her on the gurney, okay, bud? He said. He looked at Robbie and said, on the count of three, okay?
Of course, not a problem. Anything I can do to help.
Robbie slid his arms under my back and my neck, and the tech slid his arms under my knees and calves. The tech counted to three, they heaved me onto the gurney, and we were off.
Finally.
The technician wheeled the gurney, and Robbie walked beside me, holding my hand in his. I remember going down a long, dark hallway. The walls were gray. The ceiling, comprised of standard white industrial tiles, was methodically interrupted by long rectangular fluorescent lights that we passed in perfect cadence. When we arrived at our destination, the two men lifted my lifeless body onto a table, and I felt myself drift into a suspended state of being before fading to white. "Am I dead?" I remember asking. I opened my eyes and saw Robbie staring down at me. A cool wetness between my legs indicated that the technician had begun the procedure.
No, baby, you're not dead,
Bobby replied. He leaned down and kissed me on the forehead.
You just lost time for a...
The tech interrupted him.
Oh, my God, we've got to move now!
With no concern for my comfort this time, the two men tossed me onto the gurney and they ran me to the operating room. Before I knew what was happening, I was counting backwards from 10. Three unknown but kind faces peered down at me. I watched their mouths move, but heard nothing. And then I awoke to the sound of a familiar voice. Too weak to lift my head, my eyes darted around the room until, out of the corner of my eye, I saw Robbie talking to a doctor in blue scrubs. The scrubs were covered, from head to toe, in blood. It looked like he just stepped off a battlefield and had lost the battle. I had suffered an ectopic pregnancy, the exact condition the young doctor had ruled out by ultrasound, what seemed like a lifetime ago. Based on the amount of blood loss, the surgeon suspected my fallopian tube had ruptured at about 5:30 p.m. I had been bleeding internally for almost 8 hours before they operated. She's lost a lot of blood, I heard the surgeon say.
Yeah, I can see that, Robbie replied, irritated, pointing at the doctor's scrubs. How much blood did she lose?
It's hard to say for sure, probably about 800 cc's.
Can you put that in terms I can understand?
Oh, sorry, it's just less than a liter.
Jesus, that sounds like a lot. Is that a lot?
Yes, she's lost a lot of blood, but her condition is stable. She'll be monitored closely until she's strong enough to go home. As of right now, I don't think she needs a transfusion. If she wants to feel better sooner, she can get one. But luckily, her life isn't depending upon it.
Sounds like she's lucky to be alive, Robbie said.
You're right about that. Robbie looked back at me, tears in his eyes.
Oh, you're awake! Did you hear what we were saying? He asked, wiping his eyes with the palms of his hands.
I heard enough, I said, as tears filled my burning eyes. The next day, flowers started to arrive. They filled the room with life and color, neither of which I could provide, so I was thankful. And at about noon, Robbie appeared in the doorway. In his right arm, he held a baby ficus tree in green pot, and in his left hand, he held a venti Americano. I couldn't help but smile.
A tree? I laughed, then grimaced from the pain. What? You don't send flowers?
Nope, flowers just die. Together, we can watch this ficus grow for a long time.
Together?
Yes, together. You got a problem with that?
Nope. No problem, I replied, and he crossed the threshold into the room.
Remember, you can follow Jennifer Smith on Medium.com and on Twitter at Chapel Hill Billy. That's Billy with an I.
If you enjoyed these stories, please share them.
And if you enjoy this podcast and you want to hear longer stories like this, please consider becoming my podcast patron. It's only $1 a month. You can click on Be My Patron button at the bottom of my Podbean page.
Thanks so much for listening. And next week, we'll have episode 3 of A Love Story of Sorts.